We continue our journey today in Ecclesiastes chapter number 4. I remind you that this book is a journal of a life crisis. The frustration that life, no matter what you do, no matter what happens, is going to ultimately end in death. And you cannot wrestle it around and stuff it in a box and save it for later, any more than you can do that with wind. And that's why you've got to make the most of it as it happens. And we've seen that conclusion kind of repeated a couple of times now in the book. But the ultimate conclusion that the author comes to, and I believe the author is King Hezekiah, the ultimate conclusion is, after everything's said and done, you need to fear God, that is, respect Him, and keep His commandments, that is, keep doing what He says we should be doing, because everyone's going to have to give an account to Him at the end of life as to what we did with this life. Now, this book counts as wisdom literature, and because of that, we see some proverbs sneak in to the book, and we'll start seeing a few of those pop up today in chapter number 4. Chapter 4, verse 1 says, "Again, I saw all the oppressions that are done under the sun." Now, under the sun is a reference to the passage of time. The sun comes up in the morning, goes across the sky, sets at night. We've got the passage of a day that takes place underneath that sun. So he is acknowledging, I've seen some unfair things happen in life. "Behold, the tears of the oppressed, and they had no one to comfort them. On the side of their oppressors, there was power, and there was no one to comfort them." So when we've got a situation where people that have power and are taking advantage of those that have no power, that is frustrating. And it ends sometimes with the deaths of those that are being oppressed. And they can't do anything about it because they don't have any power. And sometimes people that want to intervene don't have enough power to stop the oppression. And so there is no worldly comfort in those circumstances and situations. And because of that, the author gets kind of depressed here, gets a little philosophically down. And this is how he expresses it. Verse 2, "And I thought the dead who are already dead more fortunate than the living who are still alive." So when I see how bad things can get in the world, it makes me think that the people who are already dead are better off than those that are having to live and see this garbage. And we hear people will express similar sentiments. "Oh, I'm glad your father is not here to have to see you live this way," right? Sometimes we'll say, "Oh, the founding fathers would be rolling over in their graves if they only knew what was going on now." That's our way of expressing the frustration that things are not happening the way they should be happening, and the dead are better off not having to put up with it. But that's not where the collector, the Ecclesiastes guy, King Hezekiah, if you will, ends. He goes one more step, verse 3, "But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun." Now, what does he mean? He says better off is the hypothetical never been born person, because they didn't even have to see anything negative. Because the reality is, every person that's lived for any time whatsoever in planet Earth has seen unfair stuff. So even the dead people today, they saw unfair stuff back when they were alive. So the writer says, you know what? You'd be better off never having to even existed and had to see any of this stuff. Now, that's very extreme, but you get his point, right? Verse number 4. Then I saw that all the toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbor. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. We have a phrase. It's not as commonly used today. Keeping up with the Joneses. That the idea of why we do some of the things we do is to try to catch up with our neighbors. You know, they get a new car, we want a new car. They put something in their house, you know, they get a delivery with a big screen TV or something like that. Maybe we would like to have something like that. That's what he just said. All the toil, all the skill comes from the fact that we see other people's stuff. But the reality is, this is vanity. It's trying to grab hold of the wind and shape it and stuff it in a box and save it for later. It's out of our control. We can't do that. You can't keep up with the Joneses because you will eventually bankrupt yourself if you try that. Verse number 5, the fool folds his hands and eats his own flesh. Now, in the Proverbs, the folding of the hands was associated with the idea of being lazy. And the fool was somebody that didn't do things God's way. They had their own attitude. They were only looking out for number one. So if you have a fool folding his own hands, he's basically not doing anything. And so eventually that's going to eat him up. If you quit going to work, you'll eventually run out of money to pay the bills and you'll start getting things repossessed and you'll become homeless. That's the reality. Verse 6. Better is a handful of quietness. That's living in peace, living in comfort or contentment with what you have as a comfort. Better is that than two hands full of toil and a striving after wind. So you're better off living a life of being contentedly comfortable with minimal amounts of necessities than to have lots and lots of stuff that you're working really, really hard to pay, you know, the credit card bills for, because that's just going to catch you up in the whole whirlwind idea. And you can't saddle a whirlwind. Verse number 7. Again, I saw vanity under the sun. So here's another example of things out of control in life. One person who has no other, either son or brother. So this guy is just a single person. Doesn't have any family. It's just him in his household. Yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, "For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure? This also is vanity and an unhappy business." Again, when I'm recording this, it's still before Christmas for me. And one of my favorite Christmas season stories, which we watch the George C. Scott version of this, is the Christmas Carol story. And who's the main character? Scrooge. And Scrooge works all the time. And he pushes himself and he pushes his employees beyond what should be the comfort level of work. But why is he doing it? He goes home to a monstrous house, but he only lives in a little tiny room. And he could afford to have really nice food and clothes and servant's galore, but he has none of those things. He goes up and he has a little candle and he has a little bitty cold bit of gruel that he warms up by a very small fire before he jumps into his bed. Why is he doing all of that? He's putting all of this effort in when it's just him and there's no one that he's enjoying life with. That's the picture here in verse 7 and 8. It's sad. It's a vanity and an unhappy business to see someone that lives that sort of miserly existence. Verse number 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. So verses 7 and 8 were about a single person working super, super hard, pushing themselves, not enjoying it, and that was a wasted effort. Verse 9 says, but even if you've got a minimum of two people that are working together and enjoying each other's company, that's better. Verse number 10, for if they fall, one will lift up his fellow. But woe to him who's alone when he falls and has not another to lift him up. Every year, I hear of some tragedy of a person. Sometimes it's a man, sometimes it's a woman, who's working alone and an accident happens. Sometimes their clothing gets caught into the machinery. And if there'd been someone there, they could have been saved. Sometimes a car jack fails and the car comes down on the person. If somebody else had been there, they could have been saved. They could have been rescued. But it's because they were by themselves. There was no companion. There was no one there to lift them up. Verse 11, again, if two lie together, they keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? And though a man might prevail against one who is alone, two will withstand him. One of the things you're supposed to do is travel in pairs whenever you're in a foreign country or you're traveling in an area that you don't know well or we always got told, you know, when you go to an amusement park when you were younger or you went to the carnival or something like that, you stay with your brother or you stay with your sister, you stay with your friend. You don't go anywhere by yourself. Because of these very things right here, you're better off when you've got a partner involved. Now, I know there's a lot of you that are listening to this. You are alone right now. You are a widow, or you're a widower, or you're someone that you used to be married, or you're not married now because of divorce, or maybe you never got married in the first place, and so you're by yourself, and I am sorry that you have found yourself in that situation in life. But I want you to know that you should be in a partnership with other people around you. You should have church friends. You should have work friends. You should have friends in the apartment complex that you live in. You should have friends in the neighborhood where you live in. People who can check up on you. People who can know that you're okay day by day. That's the point here, is life is tough enough to go through. It is even worse if you're going through it by yourself. So reach out in some way to find some friends, some family members that can be your partners to help you as you go through your life. The last little proverb in this section here is, a threefold cord is not quickly broken. I always think about my friend David Honeycutt when I say this, because that was the name that he was kind of promoting for the church merger that we were working on together when we were much younger, the place that eventually became Deer Run Church of Christ over in South Bend. He wanted to use the threefold cord church because of this very proverbial thing. The more people that you've got together in partnership, and we had three churches that were basically coming together at that time, the more people that are involved in this group effort, the better off you are. And so churches are basically communities of individual believers, and we're stronger as we fellowship together. So keep that in mind. You know, every Friday, I make it a habit of telling you, you ought to have a church home. Everyone should be plugged in somewhere with a church, with a congregation of believers. This is one of the reasons why I say that. So find your spot, get plugged in, stay connected. Verse 13. Better was a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who no longer knew how to take advice. Now, what's the proverbial contrast here? We've got an old king, been on the throne a long time, but he's foolish. He's self-centered. He's not taking advice from counselors around him. And so it doesn't matter how long he's been on the throne. Doesn't matter how heroic he might have been younger in his life. Now he's a pain. Now he's a problem. The poor, that is, he doesn't have any financial backing, but wise youth would be a better leader at this point. Because even though he's young, he is open to the wisdom advisors, the wisdom of God in written form. We need the people in leadership who are open to God's wisdom rather than those who just keep on holding on just because they want the power. That's what this proverb is kind of about. Verse 14, "For he went from prison to the throne, though in his own kingdom he had been born poor." Again, the writer here must have somebody very specific in mind. It doesn't seem to be the story of a Jewish king, an Israeli king. It might have been the story of one of the neighboring kingdoms that this guy started out even in a jail somewhere and ends up becoming a good leader because of his wisdom. Closest thing in Israeli history to that would be Joseph. But he didn't become a king. He was only the vizier, the number two guy. Verse number 15, "I saw all the living who move about under the sun, along with that youth who was to stand in the king's place. There was no end of all the people, all of whom he led." So again, it seems as if he's got something very specific in mind. He even pictures having been there whenever this youth suddenly became the new leader, and everybody was there wanting him to lead them into the future. But notice how he ends the story. "Yet those who come later will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and a striving after wind." So even that guy who comes out of obscurity into prominence because of his wisdom, eventually people will get ticked off at him and they'll want to get rid of him. And when he's dead and gone, they'll forget about him. If you don't believe that, answer this question for me. Can you name for me all the presidents of the United States since its inception? There's only 45 of them, right? You should be able to name them. And yet most of us, and I include myself in this category, we can maybe kick out a couple hands full. Don't even ask the question, can you name the vice presidents during that same time period? Or can you name the governors of your state? Can you name the mayors of your city of the past? Just in your lifetime, can you name them? And the chances are probably not. Because once somebody's dead, they tend to be forgotten. And that is one of the things that the writer of Ecclesiastes keeps coming back to, is death is where everybody ends up. And death doesn't just simply level the playing field, it empties the playing field. And then people don't remember you anymore. Chapter 5. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. So we would say, be careful as you go to church service. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Now, the sacrifice of fools is going to be described a little bit better here in a moment as making promises to God in order to get your own way. So it's doing ritual. Whereas what you really need to be doing when you're going to church is listening up to what God wants you to do. We've got to dissuade people of this nonsense that God is like a genie in a bottle, genie in a lamp, and all you have to do is rub him the right way, say the right magical words in the right magical order, and he has to serve up whatever you want. See, that's the wealth and prosperity gospel boiled down to its core. That's not worship. That's not Christianity. That's not the faith of our fathers all the way back to Adam and Eve. True faith, true religion is all about humbling yourself under God's hand and saying, here am I, Lord, send me. Here am I, Lord, what do you want me to do? So again, let's read it here. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God, to draw near to listen. And the Hebrew people thought of the word listen as to mean obey as well. Draw near to God to listen. That's better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. Verse 2, a little bit more explanation here. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven and you are on earth. Therefore, let your words be few, for a dream comes with much business, and a fool's voice with many words. Now, I'm not altogether certain what that dream business is at the beginning, but fool's voice with many words, I understand that. Some people think that talking will demonstrate how powerful they are and how they need to be obeyed. And the advice of Scripture is be quick to listen, slow to speak, slow to become angry. That's from the book of James, but it's proverbial from the Old Testament. Some people think that they can make deals with God. And people who get in trouble, you know, sudden illnesses or changes in their business or their work life, sometimes in their marriage life, and they will suddenly go, oh God, if you'll just help me with this, I promise I'll do this, I promise I'll do that. That sort of promising is trying to manipulate God. And that's not appropriate. Verse number 4. Here's the danger in that. When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger, or possibly we're talking about the angel of the Lord here, because that's what the word messenger sometimes means. Don't say before the messenger that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. So basically, you need to think before you speak, especially when you are making promises to God, because God expects you to follow through with what you say. So it is better to not make the promise in the first place than to make the promise and then later go, oh, I didn't really mean it that way. I was just upset. I was just casting around to try to make sense of things. No, it's too late to excuse yourself for making promises to God once things calm down. When you talk to God, you need to be serious. And you shouldn't be trying to manipulate him. I am amazed about how many people think that they can manipulate God. That God is somehow like the proverbial guy that fell off the turnip truck, or the proverbial person that was born yesterday. That he'll believe anything you tell him, and that's perfectly fair as long as you get out of him what you want. Let's never forget, God is he who is, he who has always been, and he who will always be. He made everything, and he needs nothing from us. And yet, he did what he did because he wants us to be his children. He made us in his image and likeness to begin with. And even when we sinned, he sent his son to die and rise again to save us. That's who we should be serving and worshiping.